I'd like to thank Mayank and Ketchin and that other guy for organizing the meeting and including time in the topic. I've always felt that it would be nice if time got 25% of the attention that space gets, because I think that's the right ratio on that. So, because time, after all, is critical to the problem of understanding how the brain works, in part because how the brain tells time, how the brain processes temporal information, how the brain represents time, and how the brain generates complex spatiotemporal patterns of activity is really of primary importance to the brain, because in many ways, the primary function of the brain is temporal in nature. The brain evolved in many ways to predict, anticipate, and prepare for short and long-term future events. Okay, that was less than 25%, so we're underrepresented here. Now, fortunately, in the neuroscience of time, we don't have to understand the type of more in-depth issues about the nature of time that people in this building are struggling with. Questions like why time appears to be a one-way street, despite the fact that the laws that we, or the equations we use to describe the laws of nature, seem to be time-symmetric, the difference between past, present, and future, and the very structure and nature of space-time. Fortunately, we don't have to get into that, because nobody agrees on what the hell time is, and that point is often made by quoting a philosopher from 600 years ago, St. Augustine. This famous quote, "What then is time? If no one asks me, I know what it is. If I wish to explain it to him asks, I do not know." And we really haven't made much progress in the past 1,600 years. We've had helpful suggestions by people like Douglas Adams, "Time is an illusion, lunchtime doubly so." And but I think it's the ever pragmatic Richard Feynman who just said, well, maybe it's just as well as if we face the fact that time is one of those things we probably cannot define. What really matters anyways is not how we define time, but how we measure it. And that's certainly going to be the focus of my talk in the context of neuroscience. Now, whenever we're talking about time, it's really important to tell or define the scale of interest, because the brain tells time on over 12 orders of magnitude, from microseconds to circadian rhythms and beyond. So I'm going to focus here on what's sometimes called time perception, and that's probably the most sophisticated and complex forms of time and timing that the brain performs, because it involves very complex both pattern recognition and pattern generation. And examples of that is what you're doing right now, which is understanding speech. So you're paying attention to the prosody, the voice onset times, and so forth. So if I say a sentence like, he gave her cat food, or he gave her cat food, there's semantic differences between those two sentences based on the timing or the pauses I've inserted in the speech. Here's an example from phoneme recognition, synthesized speech. If I'll just play you two examples that you should be able to hear the difference, three of each. So that's the only difference from the CCC sound to the STST sound was just the pause inserted between the so-called fricative component and the steady state vowel component. And there's zillions of examples of that. By the way, Theo Geisel gave a great talk on the timing and music last night in his public lecture. He had to leave this morning, though. And if one of my favorite examples of really how sophisticated the brain is at telling time is the fact that we can reduce language or communication to a purely temporal code, and that's what Morse code is. So the brain is really has highly sophisticated ability to tell time, although we don't think about it that much and process temporal information. Now, here's the outline of my talk. I'm going to talk about what we call the state-dependent network models, and active and hidden states, short-term plasticity, vocalization discrimination, then talk, this is a model, talk about some experimental tests, some psychophysics and electrophysiology, and then lastly is something that will be fun to talk to this group about. This is more recent work about dynamic attractors computing with stable states and problems of involving chaos. I suspect I might get a fair amount of questions as I go along about noise and chaos and dynamics, but to the extent possible, I'm going to ask people to be patient so we can focus on some of those topics down here. So the question that I'll start off with is, well, how do you do something like this with a bunch of these things over here. And the main point is that although we tend to, perhaps in the past 3 or 4 decades, the dominant view, at least from the psychology literature, has been that the brain tells time across scales with some sort of central specialized timing circuitry that might be in some specific part of the brain. It's the hypothetical internal clock model. But the general point that we and many others are now have now highlighted is that, well, any dynamical system has the potential to tell time as long as it has specific properties that it can reproduce itself or reproduce those trajectories consistently. So if you look at a pond and the raindrops falling in, the temporal information about which raindrop fell first is just written in the state of the network. You know that this raindrop fell first. And if you're so inclined to study the system, you could figure out the interval between those 2 raindrops given the dynamical properties of that system. Now, the trick, however, is what we mean by the state of the system. So here we're defining the state by whatever, the amplitude of the ripples and diameter and so forth. But what's the state of a neural network? I'm sorry. Let me just say this first. So the context of the model I'm going to be working on is what we call state-dependent networks, what we've called state-dependent networks. And Wolfgang Maas later called, in the context of machine learning, liquid state machines. And they're very similar. And we described some of this in a review. But the basic idea is that temporal computations arise from the interaction between the internal state of a network and the incoming stimuli. But the internal state of the network, we have to define as what we call the active and hidden states. I'm going to explain this in a minute. The inherent complexity, the second component, is that the inherent complexity and size of cortical networks ensures that virtually any spatial-temporal stimulus set is represented in high-dimensional space. So you're simply projecting in high-dimensional space, and that I think everybody is familiar with that concept, that it has certainly computational advantages. And this is a bit different, and this is what I'll get to mostly at the end, is here, it shifts the framework where people, and a lot of people have spoken about continuous attractors or fixed point attractors or limit cycles, but it really shifts the notion that computations are dynamic. So in a way, we sometimes put it, the computations arise from the voyage through neural state space as opposed to any specific destination. The computation is the voyage. So normally when we talk about the state of a network, everybody's talking about the active state, which is often changing in time. So this is an example from the locus from Gilles Laurent's group. And so the active state would be any bin here in which you have a population vector of which neurons are on or off. So this active state is very high dimensional. It has very rich computational encoding potential. Changes rapidly in time. But it's also very potentially highly sensitive to noise and chaos. And we'll get back to that. But the state of a network is not simply which neurons are on and off. There's many, many neuronal properties that are hidden from the average extracellular electrophysiologist that influence the behavior of the network and have the potential to encode information. So those include things like short-term synaptic plasticity, slow NMDA currents, and GABA-B currents, intrinsic currents in cell membrane, and so forth. I'm going to focus more on short-term synaptic plasticity, which I think everybody's probably familiar with. But over the course of tens to hundreds of milliseconds, the strength of EPSPs changes in a use-dependent fashion. They get stronger or weaker. This is very low-dimensional, and it's much less sensitive to noise. So there's a trade-off here. Yeah.
I understand how in a single neuron you might be able to characterize that as low-dimensional, but when I think about 110 neurons, each of which has this added dimension,
yeah,
it strikes me as...
Yeah. The reason is basically that they're highly correlated, because if you activate a bunch of neurons, the time courses are fairly similar. But there's some fuzziness to that statement. So much more correlated between them than as opposed to others. Okay, so here's an example of short-term synaptic plasticity. Now, short-term synaptic plasticity is universally observed in cortical synapses. It's hard to find a synapse that doesn't have some sort of short-term synaptic plasticity. Here's a pyramidal-pyramidal connection that can be exhibit paired pulse depression or some paired pulse facilitation a bit here. Inhibitory to excitatory neurons. Here I'm focusing on what would be called a fast-spiking parvalbumin-positive neuron. Generally have paired pulse depression, and so forth. The question is why? virtually every synapse in the corticals, in the cortex, has short-term synaptic plasticity. So what's the function? Yes, sir?
This is just following the previous question. So you're saying that the states of the neurons below their threshold of pain they are more correlated than the spikes themselves?
No, I just meant that what Lauren was getting to is if you activate a population of neurons and you follow the potential synaptic strength, the short-term synaptic plasticity, at all 30,000 synapses in a local circuit, it's actually not very high dimensional because there's a high degree of correlation between the potential synaptic strength at any point in time between those. But let me just say this, let me rephrase the sentence. It's much lower dimensional than the high dimensional active state, okay? Okay, so what is the computational role of short-term synaptic plasticity? Well, certainly it can be used to tell time. Certainly it can be used to create interval selective cells on the time scale of tens to hundreds of milliseconds. So if we imagine a simple inhibitory excitatory disynaptic circuit where you have a common input and both of these synapses here have short-term synaptic plasticity, in this case facilitation, and this one does too, it's trivial to show that you can create interval selective cells. And if you simulate, okay, I think we're all finished. We can leave now.
That was amazing.
So yeah. Okay. So in the short, if we're just simulating that very simple circuit, and I'm sorry, this is slightly off, but the lower neuron in the simulation is the inhibitory neuron and the upper one is the excitatory, and you're just doing a 50 millisecond interval, 100 millisecond interval, and 200 millisecond interval, you can make this neuron be an interval selective neuron by just appropriately balancing the activity in the inhibitory neuron. So the inhibitory neuron is firing at 50, not at 100, so it cuts off the EPSP here. It's just you're playing games with low pass and high pass filters, okay? But it's interesting to note, nevertheless, that you can change the selectivity of the neuron simply by changing the synaptic strengths. You don't need to change the time constants by changing the synaptic strengths. You can create a 200 millisecond detector or a 50 millisecond detector. So short-term synaptic plasticity in these very trivial models.
Sorry, is that clear exactly what's going on here?
I'm sorry. So this is that simple disynaptic circuit that was in the previous slide. You just have a single inhibitory neuron, a single excitatory neuron. They have a common input. So that input is 50 millisecond interval, 100 millisecond interval, 200 millisecond interval. Depending on, say, here you have some paired pulse facilitation onto the inhibitory neuron, so it fires to the 50 milliseconds and to the 100, but not to the 200. You have paired pulse facilitation onto the excitatory neuron, so it wants to fire at the 50 and the 100, but it gets vetoed by the inhibitory neuron, so it's released at the 200, basically. So this is one of a zillion different configurations of parameter space that you can create these. Okay, so I'm just making a very trivial point here that by playing games with short and with high pass and low pass filtering properties, you can create interval selective neurons in these trivial circuits. Okay? Now, the critical point is that's the model. But there's actually very good experimental data that this is actually underlying some forms of interval selectivity. So data in the frog, in the cricket, and the electric fish, and these are preparations in which animals communicate with interval codes. People have found the neurons that are responsible for those interval selectivity responses and can pick up interval selective responses. So here's an example from Bruce Carlson, and he's presenting these electrical pulses in this reduced prep. This is an electric fish at 100 milliseconds, and this over three trials, and the neuron fires twice here and here. To 50 milliseconds, it fires robustly, and to 10 milliseconds, it doesn't fire, okay? So this is, and the conclusion, they go through the data, that it's due to dynamic changes in the balance of excitation and inhibition, imposed by short-term synaptic plasticity. There's other data, and same thing in fish, in frog and cricket. Yeah, sir.
The three lines are three repeats?
Yeah, these are three trials under three experimental conditions in this example. Okay, so this is just an example of an interval selective cell, and indeed, these interval selective cells seem to be interval selective because of short-term synaptic plasticity, the hidden state. So this is what's important, right? The system has a memory that's not the active state we're all thinking about. So this is the major concept I want to get across here. So neural networks have information about the past even when they're silent because of this abundance of time-dependent neuronal properties, which I'm calling the hidden state.
And so is the time scale of this compression or facilitation that would determine the interval?
Yes, and the balance, the relative, I mean, in
part set parameters here would be maybe, it's not like learning interval selectivity, it's synaptic, it's not thinking about synaptic plasticity as a form of learning.
Yeah, okay, so, okay. So let's not confuse those two things, right? So Jonathan is correct. When we talk about synaptic plasticity, long-term plasticity, we think about learning. So short-term synaptic plasticity doesn't necessarily mean learning. And yes, most people would think of that as hardwired. It's a full-blown question about whether it's really hardwired. Yeah, yeah.
It is a state change.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's still a state change. Okay. So
the argument that result that you showed is due to synaptic plasticity.
I think we should be careful to say short-term synaptic plasticity or long-term synaptic plasticity. That, what's the argument that it is? Because they've isolated the EPSPs and IPSPs and shown that the time course, blah, 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 blah. So, and then in the model, yeah, okay. I mean, yeah, I mean, it's like,
yeah.
Substitute, blah, 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 for you. Thank you. Yeah, I mean, you know, it's hard to prove, but okay.
So if there's no input, there's no way to have time?
Okay, so here we're talking about sensory timing. Now,
so here we are just
making decisions about the sensory characteristics of sensory information. Now, what you might be getting to is motor timing, in which you have to generate something, and we'll come back to that, okay? But yes, what you said in the current context is correct. Okay, so the model, however, so that was just an example. That was just an aside showing a trivial circuit. And if anybody's interested in parametric analyses, in this old paper now to 2000, the parameter space is still quite large but tractable, and you can show which parameter combinations give you what type of interval selectivity. Okay, now for the state-dependent network, the model, of course, is not that single cells, we have to tune them to become interval selective. The model is that in large networks with enough richness, some percentage of cells, some group of cells, will naturally exhibit interval selectivity simply as a function of the number of neurons, complexity of the circuit, and the presence of these active and hidden states. So that's what probably a lot of you think of as a liquid state machine. Now, so here, if you look at a cortical circuit and you're doing a 100 millisecond discrimination task, the first, you have some rest state, whatever that is. These are excitatory neurons, inhibitory neurons. You have an input that comes in at time 0 and activates some set of neurons. And let's say you're in the auditory cortex. During this this gap here, there'll be very little activity. But the network still has a memory of what happened because of these short-term synaptic plasticities. I'm trying to represent that in the colors of these. So these synapses were used.
So
these are just a synapse. These are just representing schematically the strength of the synapses, showing here that whatever the strength was here, the strength of the synapses are different here because they were used here. So there's still a memory, even though the network is silent here and here. It's clearly in a different state.
And that is the active state.
That's representing the active state in response to the first stimulus.
What's the time scale? The biggest time scale then is the short-term plasticity.
Yes, and that can be hundreds of milliseconds. Yep. So, and 100 milliseconds between stimuli. So now you have the second stimulus, which is identical to the first stimulus. So if there was no memory, you'd get the same exact population response here. because it would just be the active state. But you don't because the network is in a different state. Some neurons are hyperpolarized, some synapses are depressed, some synapses are excited, blah, 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 blah. So that's the concept. So if you simulate this in a spiking network where you have a bunch of excitatory neurons and a bunch of inhibitory neurons, and this is randomly connected, and we're going to get out of that regime in a while, and you give one input and the second input, these are the same exact inputs. This is color. Okay, so this is resting membrane potential, depolarization and spiking. Then it's hyperpolarized. There's a different active state in response to this and this because of the information that was retained in the hidden state. So
hidden state, sorry, it refers to this membrane potential and the synaptic states.
Yes, and I'm sorry I'm being a bit vague. A hidden state, in as we originally define it, is basically anything that's a time-dependent neuronal property that's not expressed as the spiking, but in these models, it's basically the short-term synaptic plasticity. I'm sorry?
Everything is deterministic.
Yes, but there's noise. So, no, but there's still noise, but there's noise in so the synapses are not probabilistic, but there's noise in the system to make sure that it's not in an obvious chaotic state, okay?
Okay, I just asked because you said that if there was no hidden state or if the synapses were changed on the previous slide, you said that the network would respond identically.
Yes, if in the absence of noise, but in these simulations we have noise, okay? So then what you want to know is if there's an encoding of the of time in this active state in the population. So basically, are there neurons here that respond exclusively to the 100 millisecond interval but not to the first tone and vice versa here? And you can just go fishing and find neurons that respond to the 100 millisecond interval or to the 200 millisecond interval or with different numbers of spikes, and obviously then you can read that out to create interval selective neurons. Just the standard output where you're sort of using
you have to pulse the network. Wait, this is just with one input? The three traces, second pulse?
Yeah, this is like a thalamocortical input that you're activating a number of fibers, but it's like a tone. So it's activating some.
A pulse, 100 milliseconds later, you put in a pulse.
The same pulse.
And then, but you put in a 100 millisecond pulse, so you know what the pulse length is. So what's the network?
No. The pulses are very short. It's the interval between the pulses. So the pulses are only like 5 or 10 milliseconds.
Yeah, so you put in 5 or 10 millisecond pulse. 100 milliseconds later, you put in another 5 or 10 millisecond pulse. Right?
Mm-hmm.
And you find neurons that are responsive to that.
Yep.
And why do you want to do that? Because you already have the interval, right?
The outside world has the interval. You don't know.
Was time interval selection.
What's the extended time backslide?
Is the whole
purpose?
Okay, just shh. Oh, sorry.
So one thing.
You want to be able to discriminate these two. You want behavior to depend on which of these.
It's for music, discrimination, speech, so yeah, and that's what I focused on in the introduction that you missed.
Your experience.
Again, about noise?
Yeah. Yeah, so we'll come back to that in the chaos issue. But one of the points I want to make and that I'm trying to convey already is that the concern of these networks, and this will come up, and Peter and others have published on that, the sensitivity to noise, the chaos, is primarily a property of the active states. It's not as sensitive to noise in the hidden state. So you have no activity, you have no positive feedback, right? During these gaps, you have not as much positive feedback, so it's not as it doesn't have the same propensity to be chaotic.
So I have a semantic problem about hidden and hidden. So there are hidden states. Hidden states is an inactive state of the network.
No, that you shouldn't say that, yeah. The hidden state is the short-term, let's just say it's hidden state is the short-term synaptic plasticity. Let's just say that.
These networks are dead quiet without input, right?
Yeah, yes, so we're in a low-gain regime, correct.
So the difference between the different cells is coming from the random connectivity in the
random connectivity, random synaptic strengths,
so
yes.
So you have an infinitely large network with infinitely many connections per neuron, would you still get this? I mean, I just want to get the sense of...
If there's variability, yeah.
If
all the cells have the exact same strength.
If your network is large enough and you have 10,000 connections per neuron,
yeah,
which is infinite enough,
and they're all the same weights?
Small affinity.
Yeah, I mean, how much variability do you need? Do you have some sort of analytical control over that?
No, not yet, but let's get back to that issue, okay? I mean, my quick answer to that is I think the biology has more than enough variability. So I don't think the assumptions we have to worry about the infinite case, because I think the biology, that one thing we don't lack in the biology is the variability.
How did you set up the network again? Okay, I mean, what's the statistics of the connectivity?
It's just 10%, 10-20% based on experimental data. Strengths are based on experimental data, connectivity.
But what is that? I don't know that data. So what is it?
So the connectivity is between two neurons is around 10%, 10-20%.
It's just random. You're saying
and then the weights, then you adjust the weights more or less so that it takes maybe 20 to 50 to fire a postsynaptic neuron.
50 inputs?
Active inputs to fire, so there's estimates of that. Oh. I mean, depending on the size of the network, you have to scale that. But those things can all be...
What's the size of this network?
This one's pretty small. It's like 1,000 neurons.
1,000, yeah.
20%, yeah. Inhibitory.
10% connectivity, 20%...
Inhibitory. Yeah.
And yeah. Conductance base is LAFs?
Yes, yes.
And what's the
conductance base, yes.
What is the distribution from which you're pulling these short-term plasticity?
The experimental data based on...
What is it?
So the short-term plasticity of the excitatory synapses... was sort of what I showed you in those previous slides. So the here, it sort of looks like this. They have time constants. There's
in body.
There's time constants of for the facilitation is probably around 100, 200 milliseconds.
So you put in that same number for all the neurons?
In this case, yes. In this case, yes. Okay.
So you don't have synaptic depression?
You can have synaptic depression on the iPSPs. So the parameter space is huge. There's no doubt about that. But you're constrained by the experimental data, which was this, what I showed you here. And Carson, the excitatory synapses do have paired pulse depression, paired pulse cessation. It's very variable, depends on developmental stage, synapses, so forth. So,
yeah. Seconds
long. It can be.
Okay, but you're putting identical dynamics, so identical short-term dynamics.
That's what whole career is.
Exactly.
Every neuron has identical short-term dynamics.
Yes, in this case. In this case, but we've done simulations where it doesn't. It's not a big thing. Okay. So then if you just look at the output neurons, so then you just, with this conventional supervised learning rule, you train these to be different intervals, 50, 100, 200, 300, 400 milliseconds. And then you can look at generalization. So this would be an output neuron that was trained to respond to 100 milliseconds.
We'd say trained.
Because we adjusted with a supervised learning rule the weights for this guy to fire at 100, okay? Based on the 150, based on some subset of intervals. Then you want to know if it generalizes. So you test it on untrained intervals here and here and here and here. And then it has a reasonable generalization function. So this gets to the chaos issue. And then because it's a model, you can just take out all the short-term synaptic plasticity. And that ability to time goes away, which is obvious because you remove the hidden state. There's no memory. Yeah, yes, sir.
If you plot something like the fraction of cells that are selective to a given interval in your original network, how would that look?
The fraction of cells that are responsive to the interval.
To a particular interval. So if you showed 100 milliseconds that there is a cell that responds to 100 milliseconds.
Pre-training.
No. There's no training here. The training is there's no training here. Yeah. So Yasu's question is a good one. For any interval, probably
5%.
5% to any.
To a given interval. And so, you know, the ones that are interval selective at some level might be 20 to 30 or 40%.
How many intervals did you get?
So in this case, we were just looking at like these four intervals, 50, 100, 200, and 400.
But there's a large part of the population that didn't select.
Absolutely, absolutely, which is what you see. And so I should highlight here, this is more or less what you see in the brain. Yes, most neurons, if you stick an electrode early on in the auditory cortex, most cells respond to tone, but some will exhibit order selectivity
or interval selectivity
and so forth. You never know which are which. Lauren?
You'd expect that the maximum probability that the cell is selected to a given interval has a peak at some value that is 1 over the time constant. The frequency is 1 over the time constant of the synaptic plasticity.
No, it's too nonlinear to do that.
Wide distribution. Yeah. Every time window that I try, there is a bunch of cells that respond to that interval.
Yeah. It's a bit too nonlinear to say which ones are which. So if you go back to that simple model of the two neurons, it's very... Remember that the inhibition sometimes, if the inhibitory neuron fires 2 or 3 milliseconds before the excitatory, that can determine. So it's a bit too nonlinear to just generalize based on the time.
In your simulation, do you have heterogeneity in the time constants, or where else?
No, but synaptic strengths, the heterogeneity and synaptic strengths end up imposing.
So there's a log basis.
Yeah. Okay.
Sorry. Lauren. So obviously, if you give things long enough with standard unsupervised heavy learning, you can often extract a lot of the structure. But, you know, in terms of thinking about these networks and their instantiation in the actual brain, usually there are not trigger signals that say, oh, yeah, that was 100.
Absolutely. So, we're using this just as a readout mechanism to show the information there. Absolutely. And then you can try to get more realistic decoding mechanisms.
Can I ask about the input? Is it always binary? Do you always stimulate all the cells?
It's based on a thalamocortical input, so you have a series of different input fibers, and you're activating some subset of that with noise. And so, but here we're not doing multiple tones, but you can do that also. And okay, so this is actually relevant for the next question. So now we're going to look at something a bit more complicated, which is spoken digit discrimination. So we're just using one of the standard benchmarks. And here's the spectrogram of the spoken digit 0, 1, 2, 3, 4 over to 10, and different utterances. And then you can use one of the cochlear toolboxes to just transform that into spatiotemporal patterns of spikes, which would be simulating the auditory nerve. Then,
what on the x and y axis, time and frequency?
Yes. So that would be the network. You'd have your cochlear output. You'd have your simple trivial model of the A1 cortex, more or less randomly connected, as I just showed you guys, and some readout detectors. Now here, one of the critiques of the state-dependent network model in the liquid state machine is it's sort of hard to tune this, and that's a problem. So here what we're doing is the weights are starting off initially very weak. So then we have a homeostatic learning rule, similar to synaptic scaling, that says for most of these neurons in the excitatory network, they don't do anything initially. They're sort of like in an early developmental stage. And then they just increase their synaptic strengths until they reach some set point of activity. So you have some set point of activity, and this is what we call presynaptic dependent scaling. This is unsupervised. And then eventually you get some activity in the what we're going to just call layer 2, layer 3, which is the non-input layer. Then you train these output guys to go to respond to forward digit 4 or forward digit 5 and so forth. But as everybody in the birdsong field does, you need to reverse those digits in order to know that it's truly responsive to the spectrotemporal or the spatiotemporal properties of the stimulus and not just the spatial properties of the stimulus. So then you can, so this is just an example in the bird song where you have a neuron that responds to the forward song but not to the reverse song. So you want to make sure that property arises from the network and that here we're going fishing like an electrophysiologist does in the neural network, and you just find some cells that are interesting, and some of those cells respond to digit 4 forward, but not reversed across different utterances. So this is utterance one, utterance two. They have the timing is a bit different because the stimuli are different, so you'd have the PSTH. So with this unsupervised learning rule, you have this order selectivity and digit selectivity arise from the assumptions that went in. They're probably between 300 and 500 or 600 milliseconds. Yes. So here's, yeah. But I don't know if this is properly aligned. But yeah, you can see, so in this case, a lot of it will respond close to the onset. Like this is probably the onset of the word, and then these probably not.
Can I ask you two questions about the internal representation that evolves in this A1 module? So how often do you find, as you walk around, as you say, how often do you find cells that respond to a single digit, like a time to use one desk?
So that's my next figure. So here's another example that doesn't respond to a single digit, but responds selectively to a few digits. Okay, so this is forward, this responds. So you can quantify a selectivity index based on the sum to one of those digits over all the others. And then here's the percent of, this is the distribution of the selectivity index to direction. Okay?
Direction meaning forward or back.
Yes. Actually, I don't.
Recording the digits. It's not multiple speakers or different.
Yes, it's single speaker. Absolutely. It's single speaker.
But this doesn't happen in A1, right? Like,
no, you don't. Well, no. That's, you will find, so if you look at Kilgard's data and some of Xiaoxing Wang's data. So they see vocalization sensitive things, but it's not like people will see in HVC where it's second. So the idea,
So we could actually just take, say, the first stopping point of the auditory nerve. Now, obviously, the plasticity rules might be different, so this might be a learning cortical thing.
Yeah.
But I mean, normally, I think of this as the buildup with selective filters of.
And I agree with you.
But you've jumped a long way from the cochlea to very selective representations here, and I'm just trying to.
Yeah, but your point is based. Lauren's point is same thing you have in the V1, that this is an accumulative process. But the point is that that process of accumulation still needs to rely on the information on the previous step in the hierarchy. And the percentage of those cells will increase. So we're not saying this is what you should do for speech discrimination, but that the information is there, and people do record order or temporal or interval selective, but it's a minority of cells, and as you go down, they become more interesting, and that's the case in the birdsong people.
Can I ask you again about the statistics of the internal representations that this network is developing? So if you take each one of these 10 categories, have you analyzed how many neurons are active for each one of those categories, and what is the overlap between the representation for category number 4 versus category number 7?
Yeah, it's not uniformly distributed. So there'll be some. I mean, you can do that. I'm not sure you learn that much because it's dependent on your stimulus set. There's so much randomness in the network. And I think that's what's distasteful.
I'm asking about the statistics, not asking about.
But and what you'll find is, 5% will respond to this digit, maybe 2% to this digit. I mean, but explaining why that is a bit more complex.
I was asking, for a given digit, which fraction of neurons respond to that digit, not to which digits a given neuron was sensitive to. For a given digit, which fraction of the neurons respond to that digit?
Yeah.
Then if I look at the population of neurons that respond to digit 1 and the population of neurons that respond to digit 2, what's the overlap between those two populations, which is different?
It's significant. There's overlap. There's some, I mean, it's, yes. So if you wanted to, let's give an example. So you have digit 1 and digit 2. So you'll have maybe, and I'm making the numbers up here, 10%, because I don't have the data right with me. Because I don't have the data with me. Of course you can.
STP didn't help that much here.
So STP didn't help a huge amount. It helped significantly. So if you remove the STP, you lose significant. I mean, this is really, it's significant. It's very, very, very significant effect. But there's still some left. The question is why there's some left.
0.4 to 0.3 on average, right?
The slope is here. Well, this is where the direction selectivity is going up high. So I forget, but I think it's, maybe. So the question is what's left? And it's the active state. So the rest of that direction selectivity is coming from the active state in terms of what's there. So okay, so this is fairly old stuff. And the basic point here is that in our view, the way we should think of cortical circuits is that they're not encoding a static stimulus. They're naturally encoding spatial-temporal stimuli. So if you have stimulus A, what it's encoding is if you have stimulus A, then B is presented to an animal. A will produce a change in cortical network states as a result of time-dependent neuronal properties that include both the active and the end state. And then B will then produce a pattern of activity that encodes for B, but B preceded by A rather than simply B. So if I say a word like belay or delay or relay, yes, you receive the input pattern for lay, but it's modulated, it's altered by what preceded it. That's a very simple point, but I think it resonates well with how the brain works. Now, this is in the what we call this low gain regime.
That's true, always, right?
Okay. Okay. Now, the weaknesses of this, and this is something we'll come back to, is chaos, because of the active state of recurrent networks is strongly chaotic, particularly when you're in these high gain regimes where the recurrent excitation is stronger than what we're talking about.
So my take is...
Yes, Peter?
So if you have chaotic dynamics, the time scale, sort of the memory of the network is determined by the time scale of the memory in the single cells. So if you have chaos and you have 200 millisecond STP, you can still have 200 milliseconds.
Absolutely.
I don't think much changes with chaos for your next. Is that correct?
I think
the memory is just as long.
Yeah.
And still the same things, right?
I think so. So, yeah.
The chaos is not, for what you've presented so far, chaos is not a weakness.
No. In what I presented so far, absolutely, that's
maybe,
correct.
Maybe it's just with initial conditions.
Yeah.
If you slam the thing.
Yeah. And that's been the point, and I think that's been one of the misinterpretations, because people have, in doing these analyses, people have forgotten about the hidden states, and I'm not referring to anybody in particular. Okay, let me just get through this. Another thing you missed was, this will come up in the end. Yeah. we're going to get back to this issue towards the end, Peter, with firing rate stuff. So, the other problem here is that it's been a long-standing challenge to incorporate plasticity and learning within the recurrent network. So in our early papers, we tried to incorporate things like STDP, and just straight heavy and plasticity, and it's really challenging. I think a lot of people probably know that, but the learning rules that we know of are not particularly effective in recurrent networks. Okay, so this is stuff that we sort of just covered, but we're going to come back to the recurrent plasticity issue in that last part of the talk. So right now, I'm just going to talk about some tests of some experimental predictions. So one of the experiments...
That's the statement that the learning challenges incorporate plasticity and learning within recurrent network.
I don't know why that is.
I mean, we can implement hubs of learning in rate-based neurons.
Yeah. So, okay. So Hopfield's networks, they're not concerned with temporal information. So they're not time varying. They're just a static memory, right? So you're not in concern. There's a static information. When you start worrying about time-varying inputs and time-varying dynamics, implementing recurrent learning rules in recurrent networks, and it's got clear? Okay. Okay, so for some prediction tests. So one of the elegant things of this state-dependent network model is everything is encoded in the context of what just happened. One of the inelegant aspects of this model is that everything is encoded in the context of what just happened, right? So there's sometimes you want that to be, if I say belay, delay, relay, you want that word to be encoded into what preceded it, because that's what you're interested in. But if I say 1, 2, 3, 4, or 4, 3, 2, 1, you don't want that to be indistinguishable based on what preceded it, okay? So there's advantages and disadvantages. But one of the tests that emerges is that your ability to discriminate intervals will be affected by the interstimulus interval between your two intervals. So if I give you guys a task in which I'm going to ask you which interval was the short, was the longest one, in that case it was the second, but the interstimulus interval was fairly long, so there was a pause there. Now, if we do that in a way, in that we do the same task, in which the interval, interstimulus interval, the interval between the intervals, is much shorter, people are much worse, okay? That's not particularly surprising, right? Because, are worse. Maybe, did I say when it's shorter? Maybe I got that backwards. So when the interval is short, they're much worse. When the interval is short, they're much worse. And when the interval is long, they're much better. Okay, so low values here. Maybe I said that backwards, sorry.
I think I was just expecting the opposite. You'd expect, they, you know, you have to memorize it for a longer period of time.
Well, these are so short.
Well, if you wait like a couple of months.
Yeah, if you wait a couple of months, you're going to be worse.
Yeah,
got to be worse.
For you.
So, but the idea is that the system hasn't, it interferes, right? Because this is one of those situations in which you want to keep those objects separate. You don't want them to blend into each other. You don't want the state. So the network hasn't had time to reset. But this finding here, you know, it's not that surprising because it's simply harder to do things that are happening fast. So here's an important control. The control is now you have the same fast interval, but at different frequencies. So here the idea is that you have this arriving in one part of your auditory cortex and this arriving in another part. So now the interval is doesn't really matter that much. So the idea is, the interpretation is that you are not interfering with the previous state if you're using two different parts of the cortical circuit. Okay, so that's just one test of that. Now, another test, and these are very coarse tests that relate to other things that we've been trying to do, but in the context of how people have thought of temporal processing in the brain, as I said early on, people have thought that there might be a centralized part of the brain that does timing. So the prediction here is just that basically any cortical circuit, or maybe even every circuit, has the ability or the potential to tell time or discriminate temporal intervals or temporal structure if needed.
This is specific to temporal discrimination. I'm thinking about if you did a visual detection, like orientation discrimination, I would expect you should, you know, flash one stimulus, wait, flash the second stimulus, and you have to decide which orientation is more clockwise. And you would get worse. It basically would be a monotonic function of interval length.
Yeah,
it would get worse the longer you had to wait.
I actually don't know the answer to that.
I think it depends on the interval. You're thinking of a delay response task.
No, I'm saying exactly.
At some point, you'll get masking effects. At some point, what you're saying is correct because you'll get masking, but I don't know where that is.
I guess I'm trying to think about
I think it's too short and it's temporally is interpreted as a four-pin sequence, essentially.
I'm not sure, Jonathan.
Right, but also in the visual system, the retinal responses are the slowest part of it.
It gets complicated.
That's not the case.
I think the principles.
Yeah.
Okay.
Did you ever comparable to rhythm?
No, we haven't done that. But it's a good question. I have to think about what exactly we'd predict would happen. But with very short intervals, it becomes, in the situation you raise, it almost becomes what we call a bisection task. But I'd have to think about what the predictions would be there. So the idea here is just, well, if cortical circuits are generally capable of processing temporal information, perhaps we can observe timing in neural networks in vitro, or even teach in vitro networks to tell time. So in older work, when just recording from organotypic cultures, so these are cultures of slices in which you can record similar to acute slices that Ben or Ollie has spoken about. But there's more dynamics in these systems. So if you just give an input, and here's your typical monosynaptic response, and this is just a cell that happens to respond with a reasonable probability at 200 or milliseconds or so. Okay, so there's dynamics in the system, and somehow the dynamics is such that this neuron happens to fire with a higher probability at that interval. So in a way, this cell has information about how much time has elapsed.
This what?
This will have transitions between up and down states.
Is that what you did during an up or down state?
Yes. Yes, absolutely. Okay.
How much? I mean, in an up state, does this cell not have this buffer?
Yeah, it matters. So it will. It might fire at a totally different time. Might not fire it at all. So it's state dependent. Because the up state is a state, as the name implies.
Can you go ahead more slowly?
Okay. So now what we're interested in is if we can teach the network in some sense to tell time. And here's some of that data. And this, by the way, relates to some of the stuff Ben spoke about, I think, even though I wasn't here, based on what I know of his research in terms of encoding information, encoding in some case sequences in these circuits. So here's the approach, is you just transfect some of the cells with channel rhodopsin so that they fire in response to light. And then you do a protocol in which you pair what we're going to call a CS plus, and that's just one stimulating electrode, with light with a specific interval, so 100 milliseconds. So you do this for a couple of hours. So you pair electrical shock here with light with that interval, and then in another slice, we might pair that interval with a 500 millisecond interval. So you can change the interval between your quote CS and our pretend.
CS is stimulating?
Yeah. So it's some electrical stimulus here, and our quote pretend US is the light. So we're doing this for hours, and you have a control pathway here. And then, so if you look at slices trained with 100 milliseconds or 500 milliseconds, so this is just a sort of a population view of the type of responses. They're very, very variable. So sometimes you'll see the monosynaptic response and just some secondary polysynaptic activity later.
Is this up down state slice, or is it down state, or is it you?
The slice can have up and down states, but we're looking.
You don't worry about that. You simulate only during down states.
We're only simulating during down states.
Only during down states.
Yeah, which there's not really that many, but you can see them up states. I mean, sometimes you'll see, and I don't know, some of these traces that you'll see some leftover activity right here at the baseline. So you see some of this polysynaptic activity, and I think everybody gets the idea here that this polysynaptic activity is some consequence of the internal dynamics of the network, right? That's the recurrency that's being expressed. So here you're approaching these higher gain regimes. So then what we're interested in is, well, what's the timing of these polysynaptic events, and is the timing different depending on the history or the, quote, learning of the network in time? So what we'll be going to be looking at is the distribution of the timing of these polysynaptic events. And hopefully you can see that there's a distribution difference in that here we're doing the normalized each sweep for each cell, each trial for each cell. And then just sorting that.
One cell, 100 trials?
This is 100 cells. 100, no, I'm sorry. This is probably like 20 cells, 5 trials each. But they're sorted. So these, you have this diagonal band that, you know, is quicker in time. And, you know, it's not 100 milliseconds, but it straddles around 100 seconds. It's more prolonged than the 500 millisecond case. And I want to be crystal clear here. This is not learning these specific intervals. We're just changing the dynamics of the system in some way that reflects the timing. Yeah. Yes, sorry. So this is normalized to rest and its own peak.
What's it look like before training?
So one of the things that happens as a result of training is you get more polysynaptic activity. So before training, I don't think I have that here, but there's much less happening. Yes. So it's more like this, actually. You see more of this. So the training, there's two aspects to the learning, actually. The increase in the dynamics and whatever that temporal structure is.
Each is a different experiment, or these are all recordings in the same?
No, there's each, these are collapsed across slices. So I'm grouping the data across slices. Yeah, because we're most recording from two cells. Okay, so and we this is data unpublished. We had shown something similar before, and recently Mark Baer has also shown examples in which there's in vitro learning of the temporal information as a result of the dynamics. And as I said, Ben has done some similar stuff. So this is just to show that our approach is that to understand the dynamics of these systems, that a lot of us are interested in at the theoretical level, I think it's valuable to have these reduced systems that hopefully we can manipulate in a manner to teach them to do some computation, that's the hope, and then study the underlying mechanisms. Okay.
Yeah.
So here is that it gives you some idea of the variability. So here are five traces, and that's the average trace. So they're very variable. Is that?
No, like over time, when you use some dynamics.
Yeah. So they will go. So after a half hour, it will often go away. And remember, your testing is what corresponds to an extinction trial, right? Because it's the same thing with an extinction trial with a CSUS. Every time you test, it's sort of like an unlearning, right? So what you'd want to do, what we haven't done, is train, and then just wait 3 hours without any testing. That's something we need to do.
So do you think of this yourself as like, well, you're putting in 100 millisecond pulses, you're more likely to get something like LTP, therefore you're broad strengthening of synapses in the network, and you're going to therefore lead to more short timing due to stronger inputs. Can you build a story like that?
I don't think so, Lauren, because remember, if you want a cell to have some sort of activity at 300, that activity has to come from somewhere. So let's say that's at 250, and then to fire at 250, you need something firing at 200. So any scenario you build based on sort of a, let's say, a simple-ish feed-forward STDP type perspective, I don't think it works out well. I mean, I'm not going to say it's impossible, but I think you have to put some assumptions about delays. And the STDP problem that came up a bit with Ole is what we call a latency reduction problem, in which, and maybe we've talked about this before, is whenever you have STDP at the 100 milliseconds, so here's your input, here's a firing at 100 milliseconds, that gets stronger. So what that does is it reins in the latency. So STDP, despite the fact that it has timing in it, is really a bad rule for timing, because it erases the temporal information because of this latency reduction problem. But that,
it is possible.
I'm going with the unlikely, but I can't rule it out. Okay.
But then what?
So I think the answer is dynamics, but the dynamics is really complicated.
Simple dynamic, complicated dynamics.
Yes. Okay. Yes. Which is hand wavy, sorry. That's fine. But you'll see some examples very abstract now.
For the same the trait network, when it's trying to work in the other distribution.
I'm sorry?
So for two networks that are trained
for different intervals.
Yeah, for different does the longer one have a Borel distribution?
Wider? Broader. Yes.
So it's less efficient to the longer
time. In a manner of speaking, I mean, you do too. I mean, your distribution, if I asked you to time 100 milliseconds or 500 milliseconds, your distribution, your variance of your response follows the Weber fraction, which will be broad. I mean, I don't know if I want to say that's less efficient, but yeah, you have increased variability with time. Absolutely.
Is there a lower bound for that? Efficiency can go to...
Maybe you mean precision, yeah. Not efficiency. It's bounded. I mean, there's hundreds of papers published on how our timing precision varies with absolute time, and in the textbooks it varies with Weber fraction, but in practice it's not a clean story.
But you're not saying there isn't any LTP in
No. I'm just saying you don't want to create a traditional feedforward. Absolutely not, Carson. No.
I mean, when you're changing the network.
Absolutely.
I mean, supers, what do you call the, I don't know.
The sort of metaplasticity or
complicated stuff is happening.
I mean, so I would the way I think about it, it's this orchestrated changes in LTP, LTD of excitatory synapses, of inhibitory synapses, maybe even excitability. We have a theory that even suggests, well, maybe the short-term synaptic plasticity is learned, meaning whether it's pert-pulse suppression or pert-pulse sensation. So I'm going to just have to leave it at hand-waving there because I just don't know the answer. Okay. So in vitro and in vivo theoretical studies have suggested that the dynamics of recurrent networks is computationally potentially very powerful, and I was trying to get to that. But at the theoretical level, it's been very challenging to understand and control the dynamics in recurrent networks, in part because of the regimes that are most computationally, have the most computational potential, are often chaotic. So I'm going to talk about some work that's related to this seminal paper by Jaime and Herbert Jaeger with what he calls the echo-state machines, and more recent stuff by David Cicillo and Larry Abbott. So let me be clear here. I'm shifting away from spiking neural network models, okay? Now I'm going into firing rate models, okay? So this is much less biologically plausible now. But it goes into these more dynamic regimes that are, I think are relevant in this group. So in these models, you have each one is a firing rate unit. It's governed by a tan H function, so it goes from minus 1 to 1, which has its own problems. It's just governed by this system of nonlinear differential equations in which you have the recurrent component, and you have some input component and some noise component. And Jaime showed, and Sofolinsky and colleagues showed, that there's a transition depending on the range of the synaptic weights of the recurrent of that weight matrix, and really the standard deviation of that weight matrix. So when they're all tight and fairly small weights, the network is in this rest regime, in this silent regime, and you give an input right here. And when you give that input, you have some activity that quickly just decays basically at the time constant of the units. When you simply increase the standard deviation of that weight distribution, now you have this autonomous self-perpetuating regime. There was noise here, so it was already going on. The input really isn't. You give the input right here, but it just continues with some complex high-dimensional pattern of activity. Now, I think everybody here probably realizes that there's potential information here in that you could use this to have a memory or to tell time about what happened here. So in this case, if you have this pattern of activity going on here, you can find some set of weights that make this output unit. So I'm sorry, maybe I jumped that too quickly. So here's the recurrent network in Herbert Jaeger's terminology, this would be the reservoir, or just the recurrent neural network, and this is the output unit. So we're just training the output unit to do nothing, to have a timed response at 1.8 seconds. So this pattern is encoding time. It has a memory of what happened 1.8 seconds before. The problem with this is that the system is chaotic, as he demonstrated. So what that means is if now we're just looking at three units of this, this is a subpopulation of 100 units of a network of size 800. So we're just looking at 100 units, it has background activity. You give an input, which is very short lasting, and you create these trajectories. I'm just showing three of them here. And due to differences in the initial state, they come close to each other, but they diverge rapidly, and you can show that that's an exponential divergence, and it's a chaotic system. So the output can't encode information because every time you do the same thing, it will do something different. So the problem has been, is how do we get the both best of both worlds?
Because every time you do the same thing, it does something different because your system is deterministic, it doesn't have any noise.
Okay.
Is that after enough time has elapsed, you have lost many of the initial conditions. In your case, is very really different statements.
Okay, well, fine. So, yes, in the presence of noise, because there's noise in the system, it will do a different thing every time you do it. But it's the equivalent.
We're not putting noise in the system.
Of course we're putting noise in the system. So, yes, there's also noise in the system. Yeah, because you have to put noise in the system, or else you're not simulating a biologically relevant scenario. Okay, so. But noise is a different initial condition.
Yeah, okay. I mean, explicit noise or just different initial condition.
Say that again?
In chaotic system, you can either explicit noise or just different initial condition.
But in biology, those are basically one and the same thing. There's no you have.
The same, but they're very similar.
The analysis is different, but functionally for the biological circuits, they're.
Sometimes they're very similar.
The noise can generate different. And
what property you look at depends on what question you ask.
Okay, so how can we preserve the complexity of the patterns but tame the chaos? A long-standing idea is, well, maybe we could tune the recurrent weights of the network somehow, that the brain has figured out ways to tame the chaos of the system, so we can have the best of both worlds, in which we have the richness of the dynamics, the high dimensionality of the dynamics, but without the sensitivity to noise. So traditional supervised learning rules require a target pattern in order to calculate the error. So most learning rules, you backpropagate an error from your output that you decide is what you want, and you somehow do that. That, first place, that doesn't work very well in recurrent networks. So there's some recent work with what's called Hessian free models that seem to be much better, although I don't understand a lot of the details of those. But the other question is, well, what should your target be of your recurrent neural network? So in the framework of the state-dependent network and the reservoir computing, what's nice about that, it doesn't really matter what the hell your network does, right? What matters is how you use the output. So as long as it does something high-dimensional and reproducible, that's all you're really concerned about. So what we're going to talk about is a process we call innate training. And what that does is it trains the network to do what it can already do by picking some innate pattern and then training it to learn the pattern that it already had. Okay? So what that means, now how are we going to do that? So you can think of this as a pattern, that just any arbitrary pattern, it responded to that input, and we're going to use that as the target. We're going to train it to do this again and again and again.
The spatial temporal.
Yes.
And over how long a time?
So in the samples, I'm going to show you 2 seconds.
So that's really hard for me to embed in an actual brain.
Absolutely. So we'll come back to the biological plausibility at the end. So let's go for the results first. But I totally agree with you. So how we're going to do that is a variation of what's called the recursively square rule. That's sort of a traditional rule in time series analyses and machine learning. That's also what basically Cicillo and Abbott used for what they call the forced learning rule. So this is the response before training in blue. And then we're going to make that be, each one of these patterns is going to be the target, its own target. So we're going to train the network over multiple trials to reproduce this blue pattern, that first neuron, this neuron to reproduce that pattern, and this neuron to do that pattern, always by adjusting the error in a recursive fashion.
Are you doing this on the fly, or you do the whole pattern, then you compare the two, then you update the weights?
No, it's on the fly, the training.
Is the input just
locally, you're just...
Maybe you can go back to the equation.
Yeah, it's time step by time step during the training. It's time step by time step.
So the weights are
I should have a T here, yeah.
The weights are flying a ton.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. It's not, it's the one of, I mean, it's what was forced, it was just forced, it was what the force rule uses. And that's just, no, it's ridiculously unrealistic in terms of biology. Absolutely. That has to be crystal clear.
When Mary was going to talk, you said that was what was cool about it, the way she was super fast.
Say that again.
When Mary was going to talk, his big point was it's cool because the way it's changed really, really fast.
It might be cool, but it's not plausible. Yeah.
Now, this is in response to one set of stimulus spikes at some T0, or is this
a yes. Sequence of activity.
So there's a sequence of input activity.
Here's the input. Here's a product. And that becomes our target.
Okay, so then we have some random set of spikes as your input.
Yes. Okay. I'm just saying it's not really spikes, but okay, the firing rate, yeah.
Whatever.
Yeah.
You put something in one time.
Yeah, just at this time and right here. Yeah. And then, as Carson says, then there's an error at the next time step. You adjust the weights there, but it accumulates. The training, so it's unbiological for many, many reasons. One Morin was getting to, which was you have to store the pattern. Yeah. Where the hell is that stored? But the others are the reasons you get. Plus, it's a non-local rule.
Yeah.
It's a non-local rule because it's not actually a local rule.
It is cool, though.
Okay. So. Okay. It is. Who made it up? I don't know. Who do we attribute that learning rule to?
Me. I
reference Haken in his book on adaptive systems, but I don't know who. I can never.
I think he would think it up.
I don't know.
What is it, Haken?
Maybe I'm thinking of different Haken.
There's two Hakens. Yeah, I get them mixed up.
Simon Haken.
There's Simon Haken. Who's the book, the adaptive system? Who's the smart thing?
What's the difference between
who's the synergetics Haken?
That's Herman.
That's Herman Haken.
Herman wouldn't think it. He wouldn't think of it.
Okay. But this other Haken. Yeah. Okay.
But this is smart Haken.
Okay.
Don't bash Simon Haken by accident.
Okay, so I don't know who to.
Versus okay.
Yeah.
I don't know who to attribute the learning rule, but it's a good learning rule. It's a very good learning rule.
It's okay to bash him.
Okay. Yeah. Plus, we're on the web, guys. Yeah. okay. So after learning, you can see that now, despite differences in initial conditions and noise. That it's stable. Okay, that doesn't mean it's always doing the same thing, but during that 2 seconds period, the network is stable, so you can use that to do retain information, to have a memory, to do a timing task. Okay, so here at 2 seconds, you can reliably across trials in the presence of noise now generate a response triggered by something 2 seconds before. After that, it's still diverges.
So there's no explicit noise. All the other things mentioned make sense.
No, in this case there is also in that. Yeah. Okay, so you can calculate the Lyapunov exponents here. Before training, in response to two inputs, maybe I didn't make that clear. I should actually have two inputs because you can have two different trajectories here. So we can respond to the trained input and the untrained input. So after training, the average Lyapunov exponent is close to zero in response to the trained input, but it also lowers a lot in response to the non-trained input as it does outside your training window. So clearly whatever this is doing is it's changing the dynamics in some complex way where it's giving a preferred trajectory, but it's making this preferred trajectory locally stable, but altering the other trajectories in some way that they're a bit more stable. I don't fully know. If anybody has analogies in other systems in physics, I'd be glad to hear.
In the post-trained state, what? Damping?
No.
In the post-trained state, the weights are fixed.
Right? Absolutely. So that's important. Yeah. Yeah. So there's no more training here. So
essentially, you have a system where so the Lyapunov exponent is transiently suppressed, and then it comes back up after it's 2 seconds.
Yes.
So it's being funneled into some sort of
channel.
Over the clinic manifold, or for it's gotten
Talk about
falling into a channel.
Yeah. The way I think about it is a channel. I've talked to Misha Rabinovich. It's not clear if we should be. I don't know. Okay, so here's an example of high noise. Okay, so this, actually this is wrong, this is 1.5. So if you train it a lot, it can be very robust to noise than sort of what might be considered biologically realistic levels of noise, in which this is the unit. So here's the initial state, very different. You give the input, it brings it down. You have a lot of noise in the system, but the information is still there. Okay, so this is, to the best of my knowledge, probably one of the systems that's most robust to noise, certainly in recurrent neural networks.
Is
it
the sum of the firing rates of all the neurons?
This is a neuron. This is a single neuron.
Oh, okay,
this is the output.
So you haven't found a degenerate set of states that, you know, you construct sums of all the active neurons and you get the same output that you wanted.
Well, this is the output.
It's a solution. But there's two ways, right? I mean, you could imagine that, you know, I can add 2 and 3 to get 5, or I can add 1 and 4 to get 5.
Oh, no.
No,
that's not happening. No, that's not happening. Absolutely.
It's really one solution in the sense of...
Yes. Absolutely. It's one trajectory. Absolutely.
One trajectory.
That's clear. That's crystal clear. Okay. So, and on average, that's the noise. Okay. So there you have the information. Now, just as a demonstration here, now you can use that to do something slightly more complex. And here, just as a handwriting, as a gimmicky example here, okay? So you feed the input at time 0, and then now you're training 2 outputs. One you're going to call your x, one you're going to call your y, and this is time. And then you give your input, and it will just follow this trajectory. It's just enough, you're just reducing whatever's happening here into a two-dimensional space according to because this is rich enough, there's plenty of information to do that with. Here's an example where you're doing it with 2 inputs, so you have 2 output patterns. Now, the critical part here is that the way, and I, again, the terms are not totally clear to me, but just to allow me to use the term dynamic attractor. So what that's happening here, and this is why it's different from a sort of what Misha would call a heteroclinic sequence, is you start the system off at T0. This is T0. Yes, so this is zero noise case, that's correct. So this is multiple trajectories starting, so this is the zero noise case. Then you inject a perturbation in all the units here, which kicks it off, and then it comes back. So here it's a different type of the memory, right? The memory is not a point, it's not a continuous attractor, the memory is the trajectory itself, in a manner of speaking.
So taking a perturbation to kick it all the way up?
Absolutely.
Oscillations around the trajectory are dynamic, essentially.
Yeah,
but
it's constant. Yeah, they're not oscillations, but...
They're fluctuations.
And I'm sorry, is that one network that writes both chaos and neuron, or is that...
Yeah, that's one network. I have a demo here. Okay, so here, this is the last part. Wow, we might finish before. Which would be... Oh, damn, I thought I was going to finish without you telling me how much time I have left. damn you, Peter. Okay, so here you have the network just in a baseline state, just being driven by its internal dynamics. This is the network proper, 10 samples of the network proper, of 800 units, I believe. And this is the XY, you know, and if you look at that close enough, you'll see patterns, but I'm not sure, entirely sure what they mean. Let's slow this down. I can add a bit of noise. So now we give an input, and it will carry on that trajectory. If we give another input, it will carry on that trajectory. I'll slow this down more and decrease the noise just because we're going to add a perturbation. So now, the input, it's a pulse, but it's the same input every time.
So the difference between them, it's clamped on?
Yes, there's two different synaptic.
The number of neurons you choose, or what's
just the weights. So there's two different input vectors that just have...
the weight of the vectors,
yeah,
that each neuron you have.
Yeah. Yeah. So, okay, so now we give that input, then we perturb it right there, and then it finds its way back to that trajectory. So, and so you do that input, you give it a perturbation there, and then it will reconverge, in a manner of speaking, to that pathway. And to answer your question, Peter, yes, if you give it an input 1 and a strong enough boost, you kick it off to the other trajectory, okay? If it was a different input, exactly. Yes. Okay.
All the words in English language, I'm guessing.
Okay. So the memory capacity, of course, is a trade-off between the number of inputs and the amount of time you want that trajectory to be. So you can have one really long trajectory or many shorter trajectories. I don't know the end. Okay, so there's a number of factors. The other thing that determines the capacity, of course, is the size you want your basin of attraction or your river attraction to be, and the noise. So if you want it very sensitive, very robust to noise, that also decreases your capacity. I don't have an explicit answer for you. As far as we know, it scales with n, the size of the networks. But even that's not something.
The size of the network or the size of the number of connections per neuron?
I think it's, I'm not sure, Yasser, but I think it's the size of the network more so than within a range, within the range that we've looked at, from like 0.1 to 0.4, 0.5 connectivity. It doesn't seem to scale that much with the number of connections, but I agree. The other data suggests that it does, so I'm not sure. I'm not sure. It definitely scales in the range we've looked at it more or less linearly, but I don't know.
What's the large number of tables you put in there?
Again, it depends on the size. So if you use a 1 second, like a 1 second trajectory for a network of 1,000. You can get around 10 in, or 1 of 10 seconds.
And the intrinsic time constant of the network is how long?
10 milliseconds. So you're way, way outside the time intrinsic memory.
So short-term.
So yeah, I should have highlighted that. Yeah, so this goes back to Sumpolinsky, okay, yeah. Firing rate, no short-term, no hidden state, it's all active.
Okay. But how much change in the weights did you induce through your plasticity rule? How many percent change?
I don't have a fixed measure of that, but it's many percent. I mean, it's 10, 20%, I think would be the best. It changes a lot. The distribution is also non-normal after you do that. So, but the spectral density changes a bit. Sometimes it goes down a bit, but it's a different ball game, right? Because nothing's random anymore.
Have you ever tried this with a network that obeys Dale's law?
Yes, I have actually, and it does work. Yes.
Based Dale's law.
But it works in qualitatively the same way on the same amount of capacity.
Well, I haven't done careful analysis.
Dale's law looks very, very different.
But if the network is, but if you think about it, it makes sense that it still works because remember that if you have a large enough network, it still all averages out. Where it gets slightly more complicated is where, just because you say 50% of your neurons are excitatory, 50% inhibitory, that sort of averages out if you have a large enough network. It gets more complicated when you have 20% inhibitory. So, okay, so in conclusions. So just back to the initial part of the talk, the state-dependent network model proposes that temporal and spatial-temporal processing is a general and intrinsic computation of cortical networks, one that emerges from the universal presence that we know of time-varying neural phenomena, but we need to think about both the active and the hidden state of these systems when we're concerned with time. So I present just a tiny bit of neurophysiological and psychophysical data that supports some of the predictions of the SDN type models, that time is encoded in the active and hidden state of the network, and more generally, the evidence that even in vitro cortical networks seem to be able to adapt or learn to the temporal structure of the stimuli to which they're exposed to supports the hypothesis that timing is indeed a computation, a general computation, an intrinsic computation of neural networks. Then the last part, so we've just taken initial steps towards showing that chaos in recurrent networks can be tamed through this incredibly unrealistic, non-biologically plausible learning rule, but at least now we know it's possible. Now we need to figure out how the brain, if the brain does it, and how that might be happening. And this sort of creates these dynamic attractors, which we feel offer a potential computational framework for how the brain may process and generate complex spatiotemporal patterns of activity. So lastly, let me just thank a couple people in the lab. So Anu Goel did a lot of electrophysiology, as did Hope. Tyler Lee and Uma did some of the simulations, and Uma did some of the psychophysics. And Rodrigo Laje, he did the dynamic attractor work that was presented at the end. Thank you very much. Yeah. Yep.
So, is there any way to try to understand how this sort of very nice theoretical framework in which you've got the sequence and the perturbations and the snap back to your original plan relates to L-MAN stimulation experiments? Sorry. But I think it's neat. I wonder if there's, you know, if different methods for generating.
Are you trying to tie in the role of noise in the learning that L-MAN is generating?
No. Sorry, I mean the acute experiment where you do something where it seems like your perturbation injection rate.
Writing
chaos the same way.
Yeah.
Chaos, even though.
I mean.
Maybe it's like. When you inject, when you stimulate L-MAN, and you locally get the pitch shift, and the song, and then eventually the bird sings the rest of the song.
Yeah.
Is there any way to think about those time scales or the dynamics of that perturbation?
But
support.
Yeah, certainly it would be fun to think about. I'm not sure, but I think if you have robustness, even without the anterior forebrain pathway, you have some robustness, presumably due to recurrency in HVC. In which, if and correct me if I'm wrong, Stephanie, but if you lesion the anterior forebrain and you perturb a singing bird, that's a well, it will correct still, right?
Yeah, it's sort of weird though, because if you do something in HVC, you'll get a lot of stuff.
You will, but can it pick up the song? So that's the question.
It's not the same as the, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so I mean, I thought that the picture in Songbird is that HVC is doing the temporal part, and RA, when you perturb it, you're not doing anything but perturbing just the motor mass. So the perturbations to RA are then, by definition, temporally local. And but if you were to perturb HVC, the question would be, could you return back to the sequence that you were initially on?
I think that's fair.
So one thing that's interesting to me about these models is they use the full dynamic range of these neurons, right? Like the neurons are being plastered up and down from totally what would be equivalent to Cylon to their absolute maximum firing rate. So does the learning rule change that dynamic range at all during that period? Because I mean, the cortex clearly does not operate in that regime.
Yeah.
Right.
It's harder to say what plaster is. I mean, here you have these nice boundaries, but it's a bit harder, but I agree with you. But if the distribution, the time spent at the extremes doesn't seem to change in any significant manner. We've tried to understand this in a bit better. So for example, to see if the learning rule increases the correlation between cells that are strongly connected to each other. And it doesn't seem to. So
whether it's saturated logic or not.
Yeah, it doesn't.
Yeah, I mean, in a way,
the saturation doesn't seem to
change. The brain, far as we can tell, right, finding particularly in higher order areas, finding stimuli that really drive neurons strongly is hard. And the vast majority of neurons are kind of puttering along, and there's some. Maybe
but if you look at motor cortex, I mean, they.
Oh yeah, no. In the periphery, things are much driven much more strongly on average. But I'm just saying, in frontal areas, it's really hard. Yeah, I mean, what I'm saying is, in networks that I would associate with this kind of real flexibility, like say frontal networks,
I agree with that. Yeah.
Things are in this. Things seem to me to be in a different regime.
That's probably true. I associate this with motor or frontal. I'm sort of agnostic about that.
Well, another question would be: these are rate neurons. So when I talked to David Tosillo about it a little bit, he said that he had no success at all getting this working spike neurons.
I believe him.
And, so I guess are the thoughts that pool of neurons is doing one of these.
I'm not at all fond of that cheat where we pretend that each of our rate neurons is a population, I think that's counterproductive. I think people are making progress in understanding these regimes in recurrent networks, spiking networks. I know Peter has some thoughts on this, I have some thoughts on this, but it's, you know, people have been struggling with this for many, many decades.
Learning rules, you think, though, or is the chaos dynamics not there?
It's a question of the dynamics being
intrinsic. No, I think it's finding the right learning rules to control the dynamics. I think it's finding, just like we did here.
So there's Brent's paper.
You could just say
these factors and get sort of rate
looking chaos. And then they're coming out next year and saying, we got rate looking chaos. But it's hard.
They've got dynamics. So normally in neural network, firing rate either oscillates or stays constant.
They're not spiking neurons.
Spiking neurons, yeah. So there are two networks in which that isn't true. One, it was made with Brent's paper nature sense. And the other is going to come out.
But it's still chaotic. It just has the rates.
It's not a spike timing.
The spike timing case is always chaotic.
Okay, typically always chaotic. So the rate level is very hard to get something that looks, I mean, it's a little hard to define, it's not well defined, but it's hard to get
a situation where the firing rates are really looking like they're very sort of
well.
Like you said, it's probably the hard part is going to be learning what to do.
So I'd like to go back to this question of the learning rule and the very widely fluctuating rates. So this is really intrinsic with this recursive learning, recursive B-square learning that you update at every moment. So there is this kind of family of algorithms that go from doing B-square, which is totally batch, so you accumulate and then you do the collection.
Is this a batch?
No.
I said there is a spectrum
of learning algorithms. At one end is B-square, which is 100% batch. You accumulate and then you correct. At the other end is this algorithm where you correct all the time. And there is a whole class of algorithms called a box, this B-square, and in some cases this box has a window that is adaptive in size. So you average over a moving window and you can even use an adaptive algorithm to control the size of that. And then your weights are of course much more stable because they are not being updated at any time step. My question is, I don't work in this field because I have problems with it, but have you guys who work in this field, have you ever tried whether this stabilization that you achieve with the recursive least mean square algorithm can be achieved with an adaptive window box least square algorithm? That's my question.
The answer to most of these questions is yes, but there's a trade-off. So you either need to. So this, by the way, was training relatively few.
Okay,
but so yes. So in most of these cases, we haven't done it here. So here we're relatively few training trials, 20. So it's really, so in that sense, it's very effective. It's the training is not that intensive. 20 training trials is not that much. Now, then in typical cases where people have done the studies, like contrasting a back prop in real time with recurrent back prop, yes, it just, the training is much more or less sufficient, so you may need 1,000 trials. Now here, we've played around with that just a bit. And yeah, there's a trade-off, but both Cicillo and I, as well as Herbert Jaeger, by the way, and Herbert Jaeger is the first one to have actually used that rule, have used this because it's just way more efficient. But both of, we all agree that you can probably do it with simpler learning rules just in a much more ineffective manner.
Ineffective meaning it will take longer.
Yes, but and it might, the quality, it might be less sensitive to noise, but we don't know that. No, not yet, we don't know. No,
does
no.
The dynamic which you experience in these units go up or go down if you have a larger population? Can you spread it out over a bigger group of people?
So it's sort of continuing Lauren's question? No, no, it doesn't seem to be the case at all.
So do you
know it really, I think it's important.
Peter's brain.
I'm serious now.
Well, there are a couple issues. The brain's noisy. if you took away the noise, if you try to build a recurrent network of spiking neurons and make it non-catic, it's
you guys should all take a course called Dynamical Systems 101 so that you can understand the difference between chaos and noise.
Sarah, I like it tone of voice.
Honestly, this constant confusion between chaos and noise is amazing.
Chaos is used in many different ways. Yeah.
Chaos
is only defined, my understanding is chaos is only defined for deterministic systems. Right. So if you have intrinsic noise, like synaptic release, not even clear how you would define it.
So what does it mean to say that the brain is chaotic?
What do you mean by that?
It's operational definition that has diverges.
Means what?
Diverging.
Here's what I mean. I mean is if you put together a network of spiking neurons and make it deterministic, it's going to be chaotic. By the standard definition, possibly up and effect ones.
If you put together a network
of spiking neurons, take away the
noise.
Take away the noise, so simulations.
Then it will be chaotic.
You're
chaos is basically a threshold with a nonlinear compression.
But
the system's under feedback.
Oh, yeah.
So, I mean, how can you say it's chaotic and the path that's.
So, we just need local exponential divergence.
That's
the definition of Lyapunov exponents. If you take the logarithm of the divergence over the path,
so short term.
But you'll never see.
Not asymptotic.
No, because it's constrained. It's bounded.
It's the size of the box.
I mean, you know, if you wait exponentially, you wait much longer than the age of the universe, you get back to the same point. But it's really, you start, one small perturbation, and you look at any time in the future up to until you get bored.
Yeah, so
the years and the patterns.
But you said the rates not chaotic.
Yeah.
Rates aren't chaotic, but it's spike time.
No, the rates in the brain, but the rates in the model are chaotic. The rates in the brain are not chaotic.
The rates in the brain
are not chaotic. But in the models, they still aren't.
Most of the rates are chaotic.
You can make them,
like, if I reach for
even though the spikes are chaotic, the rates are not chaotic.
In the models, they are.
No, you're not